Hello, Bob. Really great.
Hello, Ben.
And I must say that I've been looking forward to this all week. Might have been because of the last show. It might have been just because of what's in my head. But as usual, you're going to kick off. So I want to ask you, Bob, what's on your mind and what have you got to give me?
I want to define what Bob and Ben are about. All right? This is Bob and Ben. This is like our manifesto. We shall not say, : abandon your struggles. They are mere folly. Let us provide you with the true campaign slogans. Instead, we shall simply show the world why it is struggling. And consciousness of this thing is a thing it must acquire whether it wishes or not. This is what Ben and Bob are about.
Absolutely, absolutely. And everybody listening to this, we are trying to explain your pain in having to listen to us. That's what we're trying to do.
Yes, let me continue. The reform of consciousness consists entirely in making the world aware of its own consciousness, in arousing it from its dream of itself, in explaining its own actions to it.
Enlightenment, man! It's enlightenment! Yeah, right. Sorry.
Bob, I keep heckling you. Like Feuerbach's critique of religion, our whole aim can only be to translate religious and political problems into the self-conscious human form.
Yeah, exactly. We're against religion and we're against politics. This is, you are actually quoting Marx. I've got to bring it down to that. Even though I love the way you launch into it without saying who it comes from, so it sounds just like ideas. But so many Marxists, so many left-wing people think they're political. They're not. They're a criticism of politics. We are a criticism of politics. We can't stand politics. Politics is rubbish.
That's right. And we, Bob and Ben, can provide a radical front for liberal intellectuals because moral anguish about otherness and difference, or what is now called alterity, is easier to take on board than principled political positions. Although the loose structure of the Labour Party allows individuals to shrug off such a charge, the realities of state power actually entail support for immigration controls, the bedrock of racism. Blairite intellectuals, whose language carefully omits any hint of racism, actually condone physical abuse on a scale no racist skinhead has the power to achieve.
Now, you've stopped quoting Marx and you're quoting me. And the thing is that Marx was clever. You know, the things he says, they rise above the petty details of everyday politics. I must say that I didn't achieve that. When you started quoting me then, and what followed, I have to say, it's out of date, isn't it? Because Tony Blair's gone. You know, it was like journalism. And you went from Marx saying abstract things which still pull their weight today to me doing journalism, and I felt the tone really dropped.
I'm glad, yes. I think that we need to move beyond, Bob and Ben, beyond what we just said. How can we move forward? Those are principles, but...
We are attempting to wake up to actually now. This is why we will be accused of mysticism by the positivists and the wrong kind of Marxists and the wrong kind of people. Because we're insisting that now is a moment at which everything could be everything. We don't think that the systems of adding everything up and following this and building this up, knowing that or knowing that person, are what really matters. We think this instant now, which is you and me talking and maybe other people hearing our conversation, is the point of the universe. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is the crux of the biscuit.
And what do we do after that? How do we keep talking?
That's what I want us to stay on. What do we do after that?
Yeah, we have to stay on the line and keep going. Reference point for this kind of structure would be sexual congress. But sexual congress leads towards a climax, and you come down from that. But we're not going for the climax, are we? We're carrying on. So I find that... my dialectic is confused, and yet I'm absolutely convinced that what we're doing is necessary, that the line of Bob and Ben carrying on has to be carried on.
Perfect, Ben. That's the issue. We are the Noah's Ark, we are the Star Trek, and we are a Zappa guitar solo right now.
Right now. improvising, expanding, creative, all-including.
James McDougall waiting in the wings to join us when we let him.
Yeah, and he's listening. He's tuning in. Apeshit guy is coming in. I must tell everybody about... No, I mustn't. But James McDougall is coming in. And if James McDougall comes in, it's the party is going to get bigger. The spiral, which we are pursuing, because all nature follows spirals, and that's exactly how to understand me and Bob. We're a spiral in which everything is starting to be included, including James McDougall.
Uh-oh, that's right. You mentioned spirals. I have to put in the Finneganese McLuhan point, is that not only do we have spirals, it's the content of the simultaneity we live in.
Well, the simultaneity is the crossing of the circles of the spiral, or in fact my vocabulary is rather weak on this, because imagining a spiral, I'm imagining it crossing between the lines of the spiral, you know, the other one, the other line that you're next to, that you're not locked into it, that you can draw across it.
Yes.
And when you draw across the spiral, and that cross section is exactly what we experience all the time. If you dig into the earth, you get a cross section of pressures of all the rocks that have been there, from layers going down into the sea, the sedimentary layers, they get buckled up. And when the cross section happens, you're looking at layers and lines, but from a different point of view. And that is really the experience people are having all the time, although they don't look at it that way, so they don't appreciate it that way, and they're unhappy.
Yeah, that's the way Finnegan's Wake is written, and it's the back cover of One Size Fits All. The Zappa album, he has that sketch, that drawing, that layered cake effect.
Yeah.
That is exactly the issue. Now, I think what we're dealing with is a technological organism has taken on those characteristics, and it plays that back to us. And that makes communication or looking for a common public space really difficult.
Right. Okay. Bob, you've got critical. Now, can you develop that? Because it's rare. No, it's not rare. Usually I'm doing the critical stuff about society, and you're talking about the possibilities that I'm ignoring. Here you are turning the tables on me. You are saying that the systems of communication we got are blocking communication. Can you explain that a bit more? Because I've got to, my 16-month-old is beginning to cry, and I'm going to go and get him, but I hope to carry on the show. Yeah?
Okay. All right. That's why I bring in the idea we have four or five bodies, that we're juggling more than just the chemical body. You can take any issue and realize that there's the TV landscape that you're obligated to react to and live within. There's the chip landscape, that's your email. These landscapes have shrunk, so they become little ornaments or body organs attached to us. That's the layered cape we're dealing with. The astral body, which is the religious archive. That's a meme. You have your chemical body and chip body and TV body. The conversions of that, like what Zappa talks about in the Bob Marshall interview, the sounds above and below human consciousness come together in the middle to form what we experience. Well, that layered cake is more complex now, and that causes translations problems between the issues of the chemical body, which Marx was an expert on, and the other bodies that you wear. So communication is not limited to the chemical body. You have to deal with the communication effects of the other parts of your body or the other bodies. And Finneganese is the closest mapping of what I'm referring to. That's why you have to engage with Finnegan's Wake to be perceptive of the situation and why communication has a problem now.
It's
all kinds of communication.
It's such a relief to my ears to hear you talking about the problem now. We have never really got to this position before, because so often when we've talked before, Bob, the problem has been thrown out to my political commitment on the left and my kind of not understanding something, and I felt, you know, but you are producing an absolute critique. You're producing
a complaint,
a critique, a whinge, a whine, but it's something I agree with and something that explains to me what your five-bodied McLuhanite structural thing is doing. Because quite often when you've explained to me, well, this is there and that is there, I feel it's like a sociologist mapping society and ending up like there's this, this, this and this, and I don't know why it's being explained. But when you put it like that, it's like you're explaining these different systems and saying they're all nonsense, you can't stand them, you're like want to rip them up, you can't bear the fact that yes. things are divided in that way, that actually you're talking satire, that the naming and the being clear about things is in order to make the other person see it's like that, in order that they stop being a machine. It's exactly. humour in the Bergson, Wyndham Lewis argument, which is saying humour is showing somebody they are behaving like a machine, so they get this shock and say, oh, I've been behaving like something I can understand as an automaton, I'm going to change. And that shock is producing a dialogue with the other person. We're provocative. We want that discussion.
Exactly. And isn't it? It just shows you the problem of communication, because I thought that's what I was revealing all these 17 shows or 18 shows. What is it? Show 18?
Yeah. This is show number 18. And it's taken 17 hours. Ladies and gentlemen, it's taken 17 hours of discussion with Bob Dobbs for me to get to the point where I realize that his structural explanation is a provocation to you, rather than sitting on his arse, his big fat sociological arse, saying, this is the way it all works, and if you follow my system, you can understand everything. He's not saying that. He is satirizing you, ladies and gentlemen, by saying, listen, if, and what he's saying is perceptive and shows the divisions that we're in. But when you add it up in the Bob Dobbsian way and look at it, there's something absolutely intolerable about it.
That's right. And that's why we have the breakdown of communication in the digital economy and in all other levels. Okay, I want to, it's very important you cite Lewis. Well, let's call this, carrying on the Vorticist mandate. Here is Nelson Thaw put out an album of my stuff back in 92, and he wrote a book.
When you say album, what do you mean? Do you mean an LP type album?
No, CD, 1992. It's called Bob's Media Ecology.
Okay, and was you talking?
Yeah, they just took stuff from several years on the radio, collaged it, and Dave Neufeld made a wonderful work out of it, and he's the one who created Broken Social Scene.
A collectible CD that you can put next to your Rolling Stones CD, or your Frank Zappa CD, or your Swamp Dog CD, or all the other CDs you have.
Yes, and you can actually hear it on fivebody.com because it's hard to get those CDs. I don't know where they are, if there's any left.
Are there any CD shops left? No. Okay,
yes,
you have downloaded
it
from... Okay.
But here's what Nelson Thaw did. He's the one who paid Dave Neufeld. I was not involved with the album, I didn't get any money, didn't do much. But here's what he wrote, and he quoted McLuhan.
Hang on, is this going to take a moment? Because I could put Mordecai to bed while you're explaining this. I can't hear you, and I will listen, but I need to put this baby to bed, okay?
Okay, so this is Nelson quoting Marshall McLuhan and not acknowledging that he's quoting McLuhan, and it's McLuhan talking about Wyndham Lewis. So Nelson Thaw is using McLuhan on Lewis to describe me. He says, anybody who imagines that free speech exists in the English-speaking world today had better have a good look at the works of Bob Dobbs, the world's foremost poet and satirist. So this is the sentence McLuhan wrote about Wyndham Lewis 650 or 7 years ago or something. So Nelson continues imitating McLuhan. Dobbs, who has always written as though free speech really existed, has remarked, quote, we are all satirists in conversation, and merely to describe or to tell the truth about anything today is to be satirical.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, you've thrown back at me in the rather donnish way you have, that it has already been said and it's there in a text, and I'm the student, you know, kind of just riffing, or as they say, but I hate that word because I always thought a riff was a repeated little bass thing that you did, and you know, the it's licks that you do and improvisation that you do when you're soloing. But I do my improvisation, and you say, "Ah, Ben, but that has already been in place. There it is," which is fantastic. I mean, I'm glad we agree. It just gets put in different places.
That's it. That really is. You tell the truth, the new kind of truth, but at best, because it's just a verbal medium, it can only be satirical. That's another communication problem we got. The, you know, truth to power slogan doesn't work.
Yeah, because it's boring. It's boring. Truth and power, they're both of them are boring. Satire has at least some kind of frisson.
That's right.
If frisson, I can use a French word.
F-R-I-S-S-O-N.
Yeah, I mean, it's a French word, but I think, you know, occasionally a French word reminds us of one of the irritations of Anglophone culture, which is French culture, which has continually stimulated Anglophone culture and annoyed it and been there. And a frisson, you know, you say the word and you know that you're dealing with something a little bit more sensual than we're allowed, which has historical materialist explanations, obviously, as everything does, which is, did you get that? Did you hear that? That was the baby on my shoulder farting. How often has that been on radio?
Yes, I just heard it.
Did you hear it? Ah, great.
Yes.
Because to have a baby on your shoulder farting while you're talking to somebody is the breakthrough that we're looking for.
It's a close. I want to just say the other little short paragraph, which is direct lift from McLuhan talking about Wyndham Lewis. In an age of gigantic, and this is in the 50s, in an age of gigantic pictorial illusionism and journalistic exaggeration of concealment, ordinary truth in conversation has disappeared. Dobbs has barely disappeared and is semi-transparent. He has been boycotted for 22 years. Girls have not yet spoken. That's Iris. Iris says more Dobbs.
But it puts you in the same bag as Eugene Chabon, and I like that, because Eugene Chabon, for me, was a surprise, because he was somebody who I originally found out about, somebody who wanted to pursue English free improvisation, but coming from America and having his time in Canada, avoiding the draft from the Vietnam War, his North American experience made him completely different from the free improvisers that I knew. But Eugene Chabon told me, he didn't tell it to me, you know, verbally, observing him, I could see that what he was doing, I suddenly understood it, was he made a connection between the hobo singer who goes into a room and tells people about what's happening, the political idea that in this room it's really important to communicate, and showed me that that was what the free improvisation that I was so into was actually doing. And I thought free improvisation was this really abstract art thing. Eugene Chabon came in and said no. Well, said yes. He loved all that. But he realized it was the same as the American tradition of protest singing, the Woody Guthrie direct communication. I come into the room and I sing to you about events and I tell you. He connected those two. He connected the avant-garde, which had to do it like that, and in the way I came up, the avant-garde had been extinguished by the 80s and by Reaganism and Thatcherism. We weren't allowed to have an avant-garde. The avant-garde retreated upstairs to pubs in England, and that's where you could hear avant-garde music. And Eugene Chabon came in and said, it's the same as the American tradition of the hoboing singer, songwriter, guy with a guitar who comes into a room and says something honest to you. And Eugene crossed those two things for me, and it was amazing. Something exploded in my head. I understood all sorts of things about rock music that I liked and didn't like, and I understood the avant-garde music that I'd been listening to. And what you're saying, Bob, about conversation. And it's typically American, I have to say it's typically American, I'm saying it in a positive way, that about oral communication being the key, being having the ability to speak to people. That I know that English politics went down the drain when politicians no longer dared to walk down the street and talk to anybody, stand on a soapbox and talk to people. Everything had to be managed by the video. Everything had to be, because they didn't dare actually face these people they've screwed, you know? And that orality that you're talking about, you know, it lights up things in my brain. And that's why I need America. I hate America, and I go on and on about America foreign policy, and I can't stand America, and, you know. But that orality, that keeping up the tradition of talking, and I know it every time I go to a poetry reading, if it's an American poet, they're going to be great to hear, you know, and if it's an English poet, there'll be a shuffling shame, you know. And that speaking, and it has to do with your Afro-Americans you've got in there, has to do with the Irish thing, which has always been very oral, has to do with the underclass thing in your culture. And I appreciate that, and obviously we both agree on that, because we are talking over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa, and Frank Zappa was particularly polemical about the oral tradition versus the writing tradition, wasn't he?
Yes, and so yes, our show here, Bomben, is Eugene Chadbourne for the airwaves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much you know Eugene. I mean,
no, I've met him.
Well, I've met him too, and he got me a job on, I can't remember the name of it. It's a music magazine called Signal to Noise. Yeah, it was Eugene who got me my job writing for Signal to Noise. So I wrote for Signal to Noise. So I know Eugene as well. And what amazed me about Eugene was that he loved Derek Bailey and free improvisation, but he loved punk, and he formed a kind of crossover between the two called Shockabilly, and they toured there. And then he formed that link with the late Jimmy Carl Black, who was the drummer in the Mothers of Invention, Frank Zappa's first group. And their duo was, to me, like history shaking hands over generations. It was just amazing that he dragged somebody who'd been involved with Frank Zappa out of all the horrendous, like, tribute, boring, reproductive tribute band kind of awfulness that most of it is. And suddenly he was doing something live and political and edgy and now, and talking to the audience and having fun and doing things that made every concert an event. And that was Eugene. And, you know, I feel that Eugene, you, I finally found intelligent people to talk to. But why are they so rare, Bob? Why is intelligence so rare? Why do we have to cast around the world? Why do I have to find someone in Maui, Hawaii to talk to? Why can't I find it next door? What's going on? Because I'm convinced that the person next door actually has all this stuff we're talking about in their heads. But why can't I talk to them about it? What is this thing holding everybody back? And this brings us back to now and the revolution. What is holding everything back, Bob?
I agree. Now, let me...
You can't agree. You've got to explain it to me.
Yeah, I mean, agree with the issue you're bringing up.
Well, yeah. It's what is holding us back. What
right,
is it?
Let me respond.
What is it,
to
Bob?
It.
Come on. No, I want you to answer the question.
I am...
No, look, now, don't stop donning me. Start appreciating what I've said and patting me on the head and going, very good. Answer my question. We're meant to be having a dialogue here. Talk to me.
Yes.
What is holding us back? If James Joyce is correct, if the thoughts of every man on the street are revolutionary, what is holding us back, Bob?
Time. Time is holding us back. And this will be giving up the ghost in about 3 weeks. So get ready, Ben. We are going to be in the center of the action. They will be listening. They will be contributing to us. All right, that's my immediate answer.
Well, now you're getting into your conspiracy radio. Everything's breaking up. It's now the end of the world. The bank's going down the plug hole. This is that, that's that. And then we emerge like 4 weeks, 5 weeks later, and we're still in the same old nonsense that we're doing every day.
Well, let's imagine maybe that's not what I meant. You blew out the circuit. Now I got echo, but that's all right.
But I don't think the revolution is going to happen from outside, Bob. I don't think it is going to be.
I didn't tell you what.
The revolution is not going to be a cataclysmic event which reaches you from the outside. The revolution is going to be something that happens in us, and we're going to go and do it. And by we, I mean you, Bob, and me, Ben, and anyone listening to this who understands what we're talking about. We are going to do the revolution, and the revolution is done by subjects. It's not something that happens to you. It only happens to you if you're a property owner, then it happens to you, bang. But for us, okay. You know, it's an education, an experience, and a trip, and a whole thing that we're going to do, you know?
Yes, and so I want to mention that when I met Eugene Chadbourne, he gave a performance in Toronto, and a lot of the radio station I was on, CKLN people, DJs, and fans of Eugene were there. He played and talked and this and that.
No, tell me, Bob, how many people are in the audience?
I'd say 75 to 100.
That's big. You know, when he plays in London, we get about 15 people turning up. You know, it's like, you know, you just feel it's really cultish, or no, you don't feel it's cultish, you just feel it's there's no glamour, you know, there's no commercial glamour involved with Eugene Chadbourne. 75 people, shit, that sounds like commercialization. I'm joking with you.
Yeah. But the people hadn't seen him in a while. They were all DJs. They knew of him, so it was unusual. But everybody knew about him, and he hadn't been through in a long time, I don't think. So it had built up. Consider your 5 15s become 75. You know what I mean? Five times.
Okay.
At
yeah,
once.
Yeah.
Anyways, somewhere in the middle of it, he was explaining something. Someone asked something. He goes, "Well, take the Church of the Subgenius."
All right.
Everybody gasped. They all turned around and looked at me, and they waited for me to say something, but I didn't say anything until later. But the point is, he brought up, I was considered odd or something, and here's their hero, cites me as a reference point for his
Sorry,
answer.
Their that hero. Was... Are you saying that Eugene Chadbourne is a hero for the Church of the Subgenius?
Yes, yeah. He has... I meant that the audience, their hero was Eugene Chadbourne, but they were not connected, the audience, to the Church of Subgenius, only me.
Yeah.
And since I started it. But they couldn't believe that my Church of Subgenius was relevant to their hero, Eugene Chadbourne.
Well, that's, it would be. It comes up from there. That's the one of the things that floats around in late 70s alternative culture, the Church of Subgenius. He would reference it.
No, this is late 80s.
Well, even then, you know, no, but he comes from there. What I'm saying is he comes from that era. I don't know why we've got around the Church of Subgenius. I feel kind of falling, but maybe this is the little dip that needs to happen in our show. And ladies and gentlemen, we structure this as a musical composition. It has its lows, it has its highs. And I'm just telling Bob that I think we're in a bit of a low.
Yes, but I'm just telling you the endearing memory I have of Eugene Chadbourne. That's
endearing,
personal to me.
Endearing or enduring? You kind
endearing,
of hopped,
endearing.
You hopped the cliche there, didn't you? You said, because the usual
endearing.
Cliche is the enduring memory, but you said endearing. I like that. You see, these are the kind of things we should pursue, because this is the Finnegan's Wakeys of slurred actuality of... communication, of hopping from one phoneme to another, if I can use such a highfalutin term.
You can, but this is my subjectivity. And then the other subjective point I want to make is Eugene picked the best mother invention, because Jimmy Carl Black always had the twinkling in his eye while he was there. Whatever footage or when you met him in person, he was the most unique member of the mother's invention.
He was the friendliest member of the Mother's Invention.
Right.
I mean,
that's right.
You know, I love Roy Estrada, but Roy Estrada's shy. Jimmy Carl Black, he liked people. He liked to hang out. So when he toured with Eugene or he toured with the Muffin Men, it was always great because he would not only perform his few songs, he'd come out into the audience like, talk to you, you know? He talked to you. He liked talking to people. And he looked down at my bag. You know, I had a plastic bag from Bookmarks, which is the bookshop run by the Socialist Workers' Party that's become the bookshop of the Trade Union Congress in Bloomsbury. And he looked down at that bag and he said, Marxism. And I thought, oh, no, American on Marxism. This is going to be... And he said, us Indians, we had that idea long ago. And it just completely connected his whole... you know, American native heritage to my Marxism straight away, no problem. You know, it's just like, well, friendly and profound, you know. Well, I mean, I did a tribute show to Jimmy Carl Black, and I could go on for hours, you know. But that's why my one sort of, I'm going to the Zappanale this year, which is the Frank Zappa festival that happens in Bad Doberan in Germany every year around this time, around August. And I'm going to miss him because he often was there. And we got on to Jimmy Carl Black. But tell me something else about Jimmy Carl Black. He's the best Mothers of Invention guy.
Yes.
This is philosophical, Bob. It's a philosophical question I want to ask you. Because what role does a musician play for a composer like Frank Zappa? What role do ideas have in dealing with the everyday matter that ideas have to deal with? You know, what's the relationship between the two? Did Frank Zappa and Jimmy Carl Black have a good relationship?
They did. Now, here's the point, is that when in the middle 60s, when people first saw the scraggy unit of Mother's Invention, they were shocked at how they looked, you know, young minds, and they might have thought that Jimmy Carl Black was Zappa. They kind of looked similar.
I know, you know? It was always a problem. On when the punk Mark P., formed Alternative TV, Alternative Television. He had Sniffing Glue, the first punk fanzine in London. He had himself photographed lying down with a load of records. And one of the records was We're Earning It for the Money. But the face that you see staring up at you is Jimmy Carl Black.
That's right.
And I don't know, I haven't asked Mark P. about it, but there was this doubt, and Frank Zappa was very elusive when he was in the Mothers of Invention. You never quite knew which one is Frank. I mean, it was a little bit of an echo of which one is George Clinton, which always happens around the Parliament Funkadelic thing. And so which one is... But Frank was borrowing Jimmy Carl Black's aura. Because Frank Zappa was slightly middle class. He was a bit, you know, he was a bit lower middle class. So he was resentful. He was kind of difficult. But Jimmy Carl Black, you know, was Texan and Cherokee background. And you know, he had elegance. Everything he said was cool. Frank Zappa had to worry a bit about whether what he said was cool, you know, because he was a bit too educated to really have that. He was interrupted in his expression. Jimmy Carl Black was a natural expression. Jimmy Carl Black never said anything that you couldn't record and would just sound beautiful. You know, it was always from the heart and funny and punchy and kind of voice, you know? Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
exactly.
And Frank needed a bit of that. So Frank kind of worked with him. And that working was fantastic. I mean, the people who would try and, you know, split them apart and say it's exploitation would be stupid. Because it's that relationship which is the kernel of every great political and bohemian group there's ever been. You know, the clever one, the stupid one, and the slick one. And that's beautiful, you know, when all those people get together and they play off each other. And they use the different things that each have. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Let me just supplement that by saying that Jimmy Carl Black's role in relation to Zappa was to be the Zappa after the gigs that could interact with the fans that Frank couldn't do himself because of his personality, his temperament, his background. Jimmy Carl Black was the guy that you wish you could be with Frank as a fan.
Yeah, in a way. But
he was the one you could talk to.
Well, he was, but he was also a drummer, you know? I love drummers, but they are people who hang around musicians. You couldn't exactly ask Jimmy Carl Black, you know, why Parallel Fist sounds exciting and all that stuff, you know? That it was a poor substitute. You know, I wouldn't have liked to have talked to Jimmy Carl Black as a substitute for Zappa. I didn't, actually. I spoke to Jimmy Carl Black as a proud Texan Indian, and as just a great guy. You know, when he and Eugene Chabon played at the Trades Club in Hebden Bridge, which is a beautiful old trade union building in Hebden Bridge, which is now full of poets and hippies in up in the Pennines, sort of in Yorkshire. And Jimmy Colblack and Eugene Chabon had a kind of dialogue about the 60s and sex and stuff. And I watched, and at the end of the show, towards, you know, right, you know, everybody was going home, Jimmy Colblack left with another hippie mama, and they're both right middle aged. He had a bottle of beer in his hand, and he scored that night, you know? That was Jimmy Colblack. I thought it was a beautiful sight, because it was so nice, you know, the Hebden Bridge woman understood what he was completely, and they were just going to go home and, you know, do what you do. And it was just, anyway, that's Jimmy Carl, you know.
Yeah, well, let me supplement. Now, you had a little drink before the show, so you might be going a little too much. Now, let me compliment what you're doing. And this is just a digression.
No, don't use this stuff. Just talk.
Okay. Yeah, but I didn't get a chance. There's a whole bunch of things. See, back in the late 60s, Zappa didn't stand out as much yet. The mothers represented camaraderie, the honest camaraderie that the Beatles thought they were representing. Jimmy Colblack was the Ringo Starr, you know, of the real Beatles, which was Zappa's band. The camaraderie could not be really expressed by Zappa. In the early years, he could hang out a bit. But see, Jimmy Colblack represented the spirit that the mothers emanated. He had total relax and allow principle going on in him. And what's interesting on Uncle Meat, isn't he the one who's complaining about when do we get paid, Frank?
Yeah, of course he is. That's famous. That's one of... I just put Mordecai to bed. But the emergence of Frank as a star, as the face, is one of my big problems with Frank, Bob. I mean...
I know.
But I'm young enough to not have gone through the 60s, so my first Frank experience... Well, I heard We're Only It for the Money with my brother, and it was sort of slightly filthy sounding and interesting, but it didn't really get me. Then in Italy, these Mexican guys played me. We had the Grand Wazoo and Apostrophe all the time. And Apostrophe kind of annoyed me because he was so patronizing and avuncular, you know, his vocal thing. It's sort of off Hendrix, his kind of jokey way of saying things. But but I found it brilliant. And I developed my whole philosophy of poodle play around saying, yes, we lost in 68, the 60s are dead, but you can have art. You can do something. Zappa's doing something which is worth paying attention to. And it made me so angry that intelligent people, or so-called intelligent people, all around me would not pay attention to it, because they just said, oh, well, it's commercial. He is just... you know, the 60s was one thing. Now, he's sort of in the industry. It's just Zappa, Zappa, Zappa. It's just personal. You know, you shouldn't be looking at it. And I thought, no, this is somebody using all the systems that have been set up and then destroyed and exploited by capitalism and, you know, ruined of the counterculture. I mean, it's not a happy story. But there was one person using it in a way that made you think and made you understand stuff more. And defending Zappa after the Mothers of Invention was, for me, a crusade, you know, a really important argument, which nobody would take seriously. Because why are you going on about this person? It's not very... commercially successful. It's not big, you know. It's not sort of huge. It's not Bob Dylan or Bob Marley or, you know, the new
Grateful
things coming
Dead.
In. It's not the Grateful Dead, you know. Why are you going on and on about it? I was saying it was because it's correct. And that aesthetic correctness brings us back to Wyndham Lewis, doesn't it?
Yeah, but
because
let me,
that
let me
anger
respond to
about
what you said. Now, wait yeah. a minute. Wait a minute. Look.
Okay.
The Zappa at first. You're young, you want the tribal camaraderie. And then the fact that there's a guy starting to get out of that tribal feeling and be an individual communicator, that appeals to you later as you get older and develop your mind. That is what you missed in Jimmy Colblack. See, so there's the dialectic again.
No, I don't get that. I don't get that at all. As I get older, I do not want individuals more.
No, no, back in your 20s you did. Back in your 20s.
I didn't want either of those things.
You wanted a mind that was perceiving individually, satirizing, pointing out what the tribe was missing.
Yes. I mean, I agree with the saying there's a closure to the 60s commune idea has ended, and this is all you can do. But I don't quite agree with the way you... I don't agree with something, what you're saying. It's sort of like that we all grow up, that we all go through these stages. I don't agree with that.
You see, in the 20s, you were individuating, or whatever it is, and you wanted the unique mind to perceive that's a role model for you. And so you object in the 70s to the mindless tribalism and replays of tribalism, basically phony, probably inauthentic. And you say, well, we still have one mind communicating, which this is relevant to what we opened up with.
I'm glad you restated the communication problem,
Frank, you felt was responding to it.
I'm really glad you restated it, because it reminds me of how absolutely wrong what you're saying is. Because, I mean, particularly because you're talking about me, and I know a lot more about me than you do, so I can always, you know, give you detail and prove you wrong. But on the system of ideas, I want to object, Bob, and I hope you object too, to this kind of stagism of the development of people, that because it's just a social high school American bourgeois thing, you know, that you have some kind of gang or group when you're at school, and then you have to be an individual, and then you have to fight to earn enough money, and that will get you a girl, and then you have a family, and that's your story. And I'm personally, I have to just say that that was not my response, that I didn't like the communal fuzzy idea in the beginning. I didn't like the emergence of the individual either. I didn't like either of them. What was I listening to, Bob? Because the reason that we are both listening to Frank Zappa is not to do with that. Because you could say David Bowie was okay when he was... I can't remember the name of David Bowie's first group, you know...
Ziggy Stardust?
Well, it wasn't actually. He was always pretty individual. But I mean, you know, the concentration on the, you know, it's sociological, it's cultural studies. This is not the aesthetic level at which we should be talking, because we should plug in our own why we really like it. Because that's unique. Bob and Ben's about what we really like, not about standing back and saying, when you're this age, you need that. And when you know, I mean, these observations can be crucial, and they can be clear and brilliant, but there was something in me that didn't like the Grateful Dead and like the Mothers of Invention. And both of them are collective, you know, look like collective, the Fugs, you know, they look like collective bands. There was something in me that liked Frank Zappa's apostrophe but didn't like David Bowie. That's the interesting stuff. The difference, you know, not just...
Yes, I agree. That's what I would talk about when I was, you know, back in the 1670s. That's how I talk about Zappa. So what's interesting about the Mothers is that they satirized the tribalism, and then Zappa satirized the individualism by reminding people of their collective something.
Well, I wish he did enough. I mean, that's my problem with, you know, I'm going to the Zappanale, this festival of Frank Zappa in Germany. And one of the problems I have with the Zappa fans is did he satirize individualism, or are these people all like, do they all have posters of Frank Zappa's boring old face on their walls? You know, I mean, maybe on this show I've already told you about my experience of waking up in Didier Mervellet's room in Paris, you know, Didier Mervellet, the I have a horror of that fixation on Zappa as the face and the person, instead of like liberating us to talk about music and understanding what R&B did and what black music did to classical music and what classical music could possibly do, and these real objective clashings of cultures, which Zappa, you know, did really interesting things along. But to conclude at the end of that, that we have to just like worship Zappa, I find like, oh my God, it's become a religion. Stop.
Yeah, that's why I don't listen to Zappa much. I don't read McLuhan. I don't read Finnegan's Wake. I'm trying to foster a revolution.
Right, right. So we're improvising now. We finally got to the Derek Bailey argument. The point is improvisation.
Yes, I just heard his song on Frankfurter Arnhem.
This is the name of an album that nobody can ever remember. But, folks, it's called Frankfurter Arnhem, and you can find it on archive.org. There it is, and it's all the musicians you should mind about that The Wire won't write about because they're too scared.
That's right. And his, the Derek Bailey contribution is Watch Out.
Yeah.
Here come the little kids, Bush and Cheney and Powell, watch out.
Well, it was his response. That was his response to the attack on Iraq. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So we're trying to do Derek Bailey now. Now, you want to, what do we do now? What was the question I wasn't asking? I thought I was answering it, but I wasn't. We always fall back in talking about Zappa and McLuhan and Marx and Joyce and Finney's Wake and Wyndham Lewis. How can we go forward without talking about them? How can we form it?
What is this projection? What is this blank nothingness?
The social space
we should be in when we're not in a social. We're not in a special social space. We're Skyping each other with a view to putting this on the radio or it being available on archive.org. So we want people to be listening to us, and this is the kind of irritation we're trying to produce. I mean, I'm just hope that we annoy enough people to make ourselves famous enough for some people to get in touch. I mean, I just stick this bloody stuff out.
Is the message in a bottle? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not in a bottle. Right. I hope it's in a bottle like a rocket is in a bottle. I mean, a rocket that you set off at Guy Fawkes Night, forgive me my English culture, and you stick the rocket in the bottle and you light the little blue touch paper with a match and you go, and then this rocket zooms into the sky and goes, that's the kind of bottle. I don't mean a message in a bottle in that depressive Adornian Frankfurt School sense of like I'm going to put all my secret thoughts in a little bottle and put a cork in it and throw it in the sea and like weep. No, you know, I want it up there. Yeah, message in a bottle, you know, exploding in the sky. You know, I want to be as big as possible, but my bigness as possible is against the ways in which everything is as big as possible all the time in this society. Now, can anybody understand that? Maybe yes, maybe no, but that's the deal, I think. What do you think?
No, I agree. We think that we can make people's lives more enjoyable if they study what we study and appreciate it and then improvise on it.
Absolutely. And study is not simply what you think study is. The study is attention to anything at all. You know, there's a piece of paper here, and it says, media research inject very weak. And, you know, that is, to me, more interesting than the idea in my head. That if you grab the bits of rubbish around your desk and look at them, really...
Yeah, we're trying to overcome the media inject very weak that we are right now.
Yeah, yeah, we are a weak inject in the media. And loads of people will just be giving up on us. And it's not trying to carry that on. But on the other hand, we are trying to carry that on because I want people to keep listening to my particular flow. And my particular flow is...
healthy, nutritional.
Nutritional.
It's what's his name? The guy in the 50s, Reichian. It's Reichian.
Well, it is Reichian. And finally, it's a sexual problem, boys and girls.
It always has been
a sexual problem. But today I just
that's why McLuhan said sex is the most important situation.
Even though he became a Catholic. You see, I've always found this funny about Marshall McLuhan. He says all these things, and he's a Catholic. But Catholics don't like sex. They're against sex. I mean, I know that...
Not him.
The people who suffer under the Catholic regime because of that particular repression can be very sexy, and I'm not dissing Catholic girls, but, you know, the general Catholic idea is pretty anti-sex, isn't it?
Not Marcion's Catholicism.
Oh, really?
Remember,
yeah, the pro-sex
visual Christians are anti-sex. Tactile Christians are not.
I love this. Because, Bob, you're reintroducing the confusion that you disagreed about a few programs ago. By setting up visual versus tactile like that, immediately seems that visual was my eyes, tactile was my fingers. And yet, when I talk to you about tactility, tactility is dialectics. It's the fuse board which connects everything with everything. It's this,
yes.
And the, you know. But you used it there in a way that makes everybody that listens to you go, well, visual or tactile? It's like eyes or fingers. So, you know, your tactile is a difficult thing to communicate with.
When I say visual, I mean the product of visual space. The printing press extended the visual sense, creating a numbness that led to the Protestant domination and the scourge we have today. And electricity is going around the book situation to create tactility, because it's an extension of tactility. So I should have said the extended visual space Christians are not as effective as the extended tactile space Christians. That'd be a more accurate way of saying it.
It's interesting that you say scourge rather than... You said scourge in a way that...
Scourge.
I say scourge.
Yeah, I meant that. We're talking to a British audience. That's the sound I intended.
Are we, though? Are we talking to a British audience? You see, this is what I don't know on these discussions, because we're Skyping this. I'm using Audio Hijack Pro to... put it down onto something digital, and then we pass it along to Resonance FM, and they broadcast it sort of somewhere down the line. I put it up on archive.org. But is everybody listening to this British, or are they American, or are they maybe students in Nigeria, you know, studying English, who need to understand English, so they're listening to us? I mean,
that's exactly the question Wyndham Lewis and Joyce and McLuhan raised. Now you're talking, Ben. That's a good question.
Yeah, but now you're mentioning the theorists who matter, and we have to say to anybody studying humanities, anybody studying literature, you know, the art side, you're studying the wrong stuff. The stuff you need to study is being talked about by Bob and Ben. It's been eliminated from your curriculum because it doesn't serve the boring interests of capitalist economy.
That's right. We are talking revolution. Yeah, you can't commercialize Lewis, Finnegan's Wake, Zappa, or Marx, or Eugene Chadbourne, or us.
I mean, you say that, and I feel slightly sad.
Because you want to be that rocket.
No, it's just, I'd love us to get commercialized, Bob. You know, I could just do with a few dollars. But
well,
I know it doesn't work, and I know what we're doing, you know, is holy, and we'll never get paid. But I'm glad you put it like that. I sort of understand myself more when you say that.
Yes, that's one thing about me, is that I'm your mirror. You've met someone who translates yourself back to yourself and has a language to use that allows you to object to.
Yeah, that's true. And it's also true that we're approaching the 55-minute cutoff. So we got to say goodbye. So
I'll just say we don't disagree on anything.
No, because we believe in everything.
Right.